Well, hold on to your socks, everyone, because climate change may lead to beer apocalypse. I know that's pretty devastating and shocking news, but look, many Australians may have to get used to this dystopian future. Joining us to discuss this and other science news is Ben Lewis, producer and editor for Australia's Science Channel. Good morning.
Hello.
Look, Ben, it's a pretty hard thing to discuss. I've just got myself together enough to talk to you about it, but how could climate change impact the future of alcoholic drinks like beer?
Yeah, if you haven't been taking climate change seriously, this is cause for concern, I think, I have to say as well. Look, as we know, climate change is happening. That's a fact. And human activities are driving it. All right. But what we've sort of hear a lot about, you know, rising sea levels and, you know, how it's going to possibly affect food security and also just, you know, the way it's actually going to affect the you know, droughts and climate conditions and how that's going to affect our weather. One thing that hasn't really sort of been studied is how it's going to affect some of the luxury goods that we, you know, kind of like to make our life a little bit better with. There's been a little bit done on wine and chocolate, but beer has never been looked at. And unfortunately, the news isn't great. So thanks to climate change, we've got a future where beer might be getting less and less available and shooting up in price. And it's shooting up in price so much, there's some predictions that it, you know, in the worst sort of case scenarios, worldwide, the cost of beer will roughly double.
Oh, that is a terrifying, terrifying prospect because, you know, all those other things, yeah, notionally they're bad, rising sea levels, drought and all that, but, you know, as I live in the middle of the city, I'm not too worried about that affecting me personally, but now it's really, really starting to hit home.
Yeah, that's it. You can't even drink your sorrows, unfortunately. You know, that's the problem here. So as, you know, our climate changes, the sort of, you know, conditions for farming change as well. And as, you know, conditions worsen, we get more extremes and possibly get more extreme weather events and more droughts and more extreme heats as well. The concern is that barley crops will start, you know, yielding less. So we'll have less barley available. Now, around about, I think it's about 16% of the barley that's farmed around the world is used for beer production. Now, if we start reducing the amount of barley we're getting from crops thanks to, you know, extreme weather events, that then means there's less barley available for beer production. But beer is like disproportionately affected because barley is used for a lot of other things as well. It's used for feed for livestock and used for other uses, which kind of get priority over beer. So even though the barley production around the world reduces by around about 16%, beer production will actually be slightly more affected. So what they're sort of talking about is that around the world, beer availability will sort of reduce, in the most sort of extreme examples, by about 29 billion litres a year. Now that's about the same amount of beer that the United States drink every single year. So if you remove all the beer that's made available to the United States, they can't go without beer, unfortunately. So, you know, that then flows on and everyone else has to give up a little bit of beer so that, you know, everyone can get it around the world. So, but then that causes shortages and the prices go up. And yeah, they're sort of talking about around about a doubling in price sort of by the end of the century.
Well, this is shocking, Nick. And whilst our federal government can't bring themselves to accept the reports of 99% of scientists about sea level rise, they may actually confront the issues of barley. Is there anything we can do?
There is and there isn't. I mean, at the end of the day, climate change is going to happen and it's kind of here. It's happening now and we, unfortunately, the sad fact is we're not going to hit many of the targets that we need to be able to avoid, you know, some serious effects from climate change. We are essentially the frogs in the pot and the pot's getting warmer. So things are going to get uncomfortable. The one thing we can do, it's not too late. We can still turn the flame down. So by, you know, moving to more renewable energy and clean energy sources and, you know, ourselves, looking at how we live our life and making personal choices and personal changes as well, there is still time to avoid, like, catastrophic climate change. We are frogs in the pot. Things are going to be uncomfortable, but it doesn't mean that we have to go all the way. It's not too late. We can actually still make changes to that. But the thing with the, circling back around to the beer, and this applies for everything, this applies for our life as well, is that while this beer study is basing its assumptions or conclusions on barley availability, the one thing it doesn't take into account, and the authors accept this, is they don't talk about water availability.
Exactly.
And that's going to be the really big issue that we face. And, you know, we're in Adelaide, where, you know, one of the driest cities in the driest areas in the driest country in the world. You know, we really need to pay particular attention to our water availability. You only need to look at Cape Town and what they were going through, you know, this year with water rationing and potentially hitting, you know, zero availability of water to sort of see what happens when we just completely destroy our ecosystem and you know, ruin our water availability. And we cannot allow ourselves to get to that point.
Well, in terms of water, you know, grapes require water and other things that we like. Next, you're going to be telling me that climate change might affect coffee and tea production.
Unfortunately, it probably will as well. But yeah, pretty much, you know, anything that comes from crops, because as our climates change and our climate regions move as well, you know, the land and the types of land, the area that we have to grow crops of all types may well change, and you know, there's going to be periods of adaptation involved in that. The real problem is, you know, people say, oh, but the climate's always changed all through history. Yeah, it has. The people who tell you that are scientists. Like, sure, climate scientists know all this stuff. What we're doing is we're driving it far, far faster than it's ever been done before. So all through history, and we can look back tens of thousands of years at climate records and see the sort of changes that the Earth has gone through, if not longer. But what we're doing is we're going off the cliff. We're moving that quickly. We are shooting up in the elevator rather than walking along a rambling hill.
Well, one can only imagine the immense cultural implications of no longer being able to socialise over a cold one. So it's definitely something to mull over. Ben Lewis from Australia Science Channel is with us talking about the latest research in the science world. The looming presence of what appears to be giant googly eyes at a French airport is not just for amusement. What's going on there,
Ben? Birds and airports and airplanes really don't mix.
They don't get on.
They don't get on at all. You know, there's bird strike incidents all around the world, you know, quite often as well. And some of those end up in serious damage to planes. So we want to try to keep birds away from airports. That kind of goes without saying. Some French scientists and researchers have come up with a little bit of a new idea on how to do that. They've taken giant LCD screens and placed them around an airport in France and put what essentially look like googly eyes on these screens. And the googly eyes sort of just slowly increase in size. And for some reason, birds get completely and utterly freaked out by that. And they stay the heck away from the area. They see these screens with these googly eyes and think, I'm staying away from that, and they stay away from the airport. And they by doing this, they managed to, you know, really reduce the number of birds that were hanging around the airport, which hopefully will make everything a little bit safer.
Well, it's certainly better than sound grenades and all the other things that they use to keep birds away. And I suppose they probably think they're predators, but I just need to be sure. Are they affecting the pilots?
No, there weren't any pilots complaining about the googly eyes, but in particular, they were thinking about the birds in the area that were... They're a type of bird called a raptor, so that includes kind of, eagles and birds like that. You know, so quite sort of large birds. But the scientists sort of sat down, we started thinking about what sort of visual effects and visual illusions can we make to try to, you know, scare birds away from the area. And they went through a whole bunch of different shapes that they showed birds and see how the birds reacted. You know, there were stars and there were circles and there were random shapes, and yet it was the googly eyes that really, really freaked the birds out. So they went through about 300 tests to try to work out what the best shapes were for these screens and came up with the googly eyes. They then took these screens down to the airport, put them around, and yeah, what they sort of think is happening, because the googly eyes sort of slowly get bigger on the screen, eagles and other of those sort of, you know, predatory and birds, hawks, etc., have amazing eyesight, but they're also really, really easy to trick. You know, they can see, you know, like a mouse, you know, kilometers away on the ground, potentially, you know, very, very long distance. They can see incredible detail. So what they think is happening is, as the birds are flying around, they see these screens with the googly eyes, but because their vision is kind of so good, they pick it up really, really well, and they can see all the definition in it. And because the eyes are then getting slightly bigger, it freaks the bird out, because the bird kind of thinks that it's a different animal, maybe a different bird, and there's about to be a collision with them. So they see these eyes getting bigger. They think, oh my God, there's about to be a collision. And they sort of veer away from the airport and veer away from those eyes. So that's what the scientists think might be happening. But really, we don't really know. Because although the birds can sort of see these eyes really, really well, they can't see planes at all well, which is why they tend to collide with them.
Mm.
So, yeah, there's a few sort of questions about exactly why this works, but it sort of appears that birds absolutely hate googly eyes on screens.
Well, there you go. Forget your scarecrows. You just need a big pair of googly eyes on a screen, slowly getting bigger, and we'll keep the birds off that barley. So, baby-making science, it's crossed a new threshold, which is always, you know, quite a profound thing, at least in rodents in this case. Scientists in China, what have they been able to achieve, Ben?
Yeah, for the first time ever, scientists have managed to make babies that are genetically, related from same-sex couples in mice. So in this case, they had two female mice. They took the genetic information from them. They managed to make offspring. They managed to make babies from two female mice. And those studies went really, really well. They actually produced about 29 live mice from two female mouse parents. And most of those mice were completely fine. They grew up. They actually had babies of their own from, you know, heterosexual, mating. And that worked really well. So the scientists then thought, oh, I wonder if we can do the same from males and from two male genetic parents. And unfortunately, that didn't go so well. And they didn't have any live mice, or the mice that were born live basically lasted about 48 hours before they died. So at the moment, it seems that we can make offspring from two female mice. Two male mice is a lot more difficult, and there's still some challenges there.
Just to clarify, I'm sure everyone's wondering, did one of the male mice actually give birth? How did that work?
Okay, so this is quite nuts and bolts, you know, sort of genetic engineering. And really, that's what this study was about. It was about trying to work out, you know, the sort of genetics that happen when, genetic information from two parents comes together to form an embryo. So in the case of the two female parents, what they did is they took an egg from one female parent and took the genes out of it and removed all these sort of like tags that get placed on genes. It's a process that's called imprinting. So when you produce reproductive cells, they get your DNA in it gets all these tags, and it's basically tags that say this comes from a male if you're a male, or this comes from a female if you're a female. So they had to remove all those tags from one of the parents. They then took that genetic information and put it into a second embryo from a different mother, and because that second embryo still had all the female tags on it. If you put two lots of female tag DNA together, the embryo won't be viable. You know, it'll say, well, hang on, so I've got two lots of female DNA here. That's not right, and it won't be viable. So by removing all those tags, they basically managed to trick the second embryo into taking the female DNA, because it didn't recognize it was female DNA before. Mm-hmm. So that's how they managed to make the two female parent embryos.
Mm.
Obviously, males don't produce eggs, so it's a lot more difficult. They basically had to do that with sperm, but then take an embryo from a female mouse, remove all the genetic information out of it, so remove the nucleus, which is where all the DNA is kept, remove that entirely, and use that as a shell for two sets of male DNA coming in, one that had all its imprinting information removed and one that was normal. Put that into you know, a female embryo shell, essentially. They then implanted that into a surrogate mother. And it's all those sort of extra steps which they think is where the problems came in, trying to create a two-father, you know, offspring. You know, there's a lot more difficulty in that sort of process. And then, you know, trying to implant the embryo into a surrogate mother caused a whole bunch of extra issues as well. So it's a much more complex issue. Now, even though they've managed to make this work relatively well in mice, this isn't really something we're going to do in humans anytime soon. Incredibly difficult. There's a lot of ethical questions around this sort of genetic manipulation on the very, very basis level as well. And we don't know whether or not there are sort of any, you know, genetic defects that were sort of introduced through this process as well. So there's a lot of work before you even get to thinking about putting this, trying this out in humans.
Well, mice have obviously been calling out for this sort of thing for years. Mm-hmm. Now that they've nailed it in mice, is there any possibility that they might start looking at, say, turtles who are affected, where gender is affected by climate, and you can sometimes end up with a huge number of females being born and no males because of the temperature at which the eggs were hatching?
Yeah, so that's really interesting because that is a slightly different process where, yeah, the temperature, as you said, sort of reaches a threshold which changes the sex selection of the offspring. In this case, because if you're taking two female parents, you're only going to have female offspring. In this case, you sort of can't force that to be then a male offspring. This sort of, same-sex parent thing does happen in nature a little bit. It's called parthenogenesis, where you can actually have two mothers producing an offspring. It's sort of recreating what we see in nature a little bit, but it doesn't happen at all in humans, and doesn't really happen in, a lot of sort of like human-related species as well. So yeah, you know, the sort of idea of expanding this out to different species is one. Once we sort of, you know, work out a little bit more about how it happens in mice, then maybe we can start looking at other species as well, seeing if we can do the same thing and looking at, you know, the sort of effects that has, and maybe start thinking about, yeah, some of this sort of like population security and make sure we don't lose some vulnerable species through this sort of process.
Well, Ben Lewis, thank you so much for coming in and joining us again on Breakfast this morning.
It's been fun as always.
Fantastic scientific insights there from Ben Lewis from Australia's Science Channel.